Accession number 8667, row number 3.
Mr. Barton, reel 3.
As regards the actual fighting, hand-to-hand fighting or anything like that, as I say, the majority of that, by the time we got there, had finished. And it consisted chiefly of sporadic raids to capture a few trenches that were causing us trouble or whatnot. Well, of course, you went over to the top with your rifle and bayonet. There'd be a bombardment of the trenches first before we went. And then we would go over, and by the time we got over there, and very often the Turks had scooted back. But if they were in the trenches, well, you kept firing your rifle as fast as you could. All we had was rifles. We hadn't got any other, you know, pistols or anything like that. And if you saw a group running backwards, you'd throw your hand grenade to them, at them. And but it all happened so quick and fast that, you know, it's really a misty memory, really. And there was a lot of noise and cheering and shouting and screaming and cries of wounded and stretcher bearers here and stretcher bearers there, that much of it has left of it, you know, a vague memory of what happened. All you knew is that you were fighting for your life, and if you didn't get the man in front of you, he got you. And you'd have your bayonet, and if somebody was in front of you, you were lucky enough to bayonet him, well, you bayonet him, that was all, and you went on, you thought nothing of it. But not until afterwards it used to get back at you. When the scrap was over, you used to think back on it and think of the chaps who were killed and the chaps who were on your left who were wounded and whatnot, and the noise. And but really it is just a vague memory. And all that time, I say, shells would be falling round you, and, well, I don't know.
Were you ever wounded?
Yes, I was slightly wounded on one occasion. I was very lucky. And this was, we were standing in the trench one morning of what we call Stand 2. That was about dawn, because that was very often when attacks were launched early in the morning. And we were standing in the trench with our backs to the wall of the trench, and the Turks at that time had got another weapon, a particularly nasty shell called a whiz-bang. And they called it a whiz-bang because that's what it sounded like. It would come out with a whiz-bang, and you got no warning. Whereas with a normal high-explosive shell, it would scream over you. You know, it coming, and you could gauge pretty well by the whine where it was going to fall. You'd hear it come, bonk, like you heard the shell bombs falling perhaps in the Blitz. But with the whiz-bang, it was so swift that you didn't get a chance. And it exploded and scattered shrapnel around balls. All over the place, and was rather deadly. And they used to be able to drop them so that it fell near the edge of opening of the trench. And on this particular occasion, I was standing there with several other fellows in this sector, and one came over without any warning, bang, and that was it. Well, the chap on my right, he was killed. The chap on the left was badly wounded. I was hit in the back of the neck. As it was cold, I'd got on goodness knows how many clothes. I think I'd got on about a couple of tunics, two or three woolen sweaters, woolen cardigans, and a thick overcoat and mufflers around my neck. And a bullet, one of these round bullets, had hit me in the back of the neck and gone right through all that thickness of clothing. And of course, I felt the impact on the back of my spine. And of course I shouted, "Oh, I'm hit see? Well, somebody rushed to me and pulled open, I said, "Where?" And pointed at the back. They pulled open the tunic and jacket and got all these clothes, and finally one chap said, "Hey, he got hold of the bullet." And of course it was red hot. When they fire from these shells, they're red hot, and it was burning me, and it burnt him when he picked hold of it, and he dropped it, silly clot. Well, I wanted to keep it, but he dropped it in the slush at the bottom of the trench, so I didn't get it. But anyway, it had only grazed my spine and that. But anyway, I was taken to the, well, it wasn't a field dressing station, it was only a place where there was a chap with some medical supplies about two trenches back, and I think he put a bandage on it at the time, and I was given the rest of the day off, which meant that I stayed in the trench about 5 or 6 yards away from the front line. That was the rest. I say today I should have been flown by helicopter home to England to a nice comfortable bed in a hospital, I expect. Anyway, I had that day off, that was all. But funny enough, the next day, Major Nathan, later Lord Nathan, he was our commanding officer, came round the trenches with an officer, Lieutenant Stapleton, who'd just joined us from Egypt. He had been in Malta with us too. And coming round the trenches, Major Nathan saw me, so he said, "Oh," he said, "do you remember Boughton, I expect?" And Lieutenant Stapleton said, "Oh, yes." So he said, "Well," he said, Major Nathan said, "he was hit in the back of the neck with a shell yesterday." And Lieutenant Naples said, "Was he?" He said, "What, a whole shell?" Lord Nathan said, "No, man, not of course he wouldn't be here now." He said, "A bullet from the shell." So he said, "Oh, see." But I thought I'd been hit in the back of the neck with a whole shell. That would have been it. But anyway, that was the only wound that I got. I had several narrow escapes on several occasions when I was... I remember one or two occasions when I was building sandbags up on the edge of the trench. On one particular occasion, I'd been working on that for some time, and chucking these sandbags up, and another chap said, "All right, B," he said, "I'll relieve you now." And I stepped down, and he got up with a sandbag to put up there, and the first sandbag he put up, a sniper got him. So if it had been me putting up that bag, that would have been me. And several other narrow escapes happened like that, and falling down trenches and in the attacks and one thing and another. I don't know, you can't remember just what happened. It's impossible to remember it in detail. It's so much confusion and noise. And anyway, I was lucky, I suppose. I was always fit, and I think I said, I had never even broke my glasses. I only had one pair of glasses with me. And without them, I was pretty well blind, and I never broke them. On several occasions, I was tempted to, I might add, because if I'd have broken them, I should have been blind, and I should have got sent off. And several of my pals tried to kid me or to break them. I said, "Go on, B, break them and get sent off." But I didn't. I wanted to see it through.
What were your duties?
Well, the duties were just being stuck in the trenches all the time, dear. You were just there on guard duty, you see. You were 2 hours on and 4 hours off. You'd repair the trenches when they were smashed, and you'd go down to the beach and bring up ammunition and supplies at the trenches. Of course, I say, we'd have to dig a new trench because so that the Turks couldn't enfilade it, but apart from that, there was nothing else that we could do. There was no drilling or marching or anything of that. That you were just stuck in these trenches. And I say there was no village or anywhere at the back where you could go to at night, or you were confined to those trenches and that sector that you were in. And as regards news and things like that, well, you relied on things that came along by word of mouth. You didn't get any papers or messages from home, or there was no radio or anything, contact like there is today. And you just lived on rumours. And the spasmodic news you'd pick up from somebody who had been down the beach and spoken to somebody who had just come over from Egypt, and you'd get some yarn about what was happening and that we were all going to be taken off, and that the next minute we weren't going to be taken off, that you really didn't know what was happening.
What was morale like amongst the troops?
Morale was very poor. As a matter of fact, and of course, you see, most of the 29th Division were regular troops from India, seasoned men who'd been under fire and trained for years, regular soldiers. But our poor battalion, they were just a nondescript lot who'd had 6 months' training in Malta. That's all the training that we'd had, you see, and some lessons on the range, in rifle range, in firing, and the throwing of bombs and that sort of thing, and bayonet drill. But these other men from the 29th Division, they were hardened soldiers, and they took a very poor view of our lot. And of course, they were chaps who weren't really physically fit. And a matter of fact, I believe they used to call us the Go Sick Battalion, because there were so many of them who used to go sick. They couldn't stand it. I think that my training with the cadets and all that, it stood me in good stead, because I knew some of them didn't know one end of a rifle from another. But I'd had, 3 or 4 years good training in the cadets. But and of course, because of that, Major Nathan, he had quite a good opinion of me. But I suppose I was one of the few who knew much about it, and he badly wanted me to take stripes and become sergeant or even to become commissioned. But I wouldn't do it, you see. I knew damn well that I couldn't see well enough. What was the good of me being put in charge of a squad of men when I couldn't see to look after myself? So I nearly got court-martialed once because he made me sergeant and I refused, and put him in company orders, and I refused to accept them. And he threatened me with all sorts of dire trouble. And he said he thought I was the most unambitious man that he'd ever met. How little he knew. But it wasn't until years after the war was over, and at one of our reunion dinners, when we're talking about this, that I told him the reason why. And he was very surprised. He never knew, he never guessed that I couldn't see. No. And yet, he and I think, were practically the only two that went right through that campaign from the time we landed till we came off at Cape Ellice. We were in the Civil Bay evacuation together, came off in the last boat, and we were in the Cape Ellice evacuation, came off in the last boat. But I really think, as far as I know, that we were the only two that went right through that campaign from the time we landed. I mean, there was, I suppose, about 800 or 900 of us who landed, but when we came off eventually from Cape Ellice, there was only 120 left. They weren't all killed, but they were nearly all casualties and sickness and goodness knows what. And today, well, I don't know anybody else alive in the battalion who was in the battalion. Did Lord Nathan has gone.
Did you wear your glasses in the trenches?
I wore my glasses all the time, couldn't see without them, dear. Without those I'm blind. I can't see you without them. I can't see that clock. I can see a few things along the shelf, and I can see you there, but I can't see your face or anything. Without them I can't see, and that's, I've always been like that. But
so they knew you had troubled eyesight?
Oh well, so my pals did. The others didn't at the time, otherwise they wouldn't have let me go. No, I remember at night time, when I used to go on night patrols, on one occasion my pals knew, and they used to stick by me and guide me. And on one occasion they said, look out, there's a trench, jump. And I jumped, but I jumped the wrong way, and I went down the blooming trench, and my pack and rifle got fixed across the trench, and they couldn't get me out. I got fixed. But I did get out eventually. But there was all sorts of other occasions when, you know, eyesight was a blooming, drawback. But the chaps liked me to go with them because I've got exceptionally good hearing, very keen hearing. And I could hear things that they couldn't hear when we were out on night patrol, and because what they call listening patrol, we used to go out each night between the out trenches and the Turkish trenches, and you could hear the Turks talking, and you could gather and hear them digging or whatnot, and you were listening to hear what was going on over there, and I could tell them which direction the sounds and things were coming from. They could see, but they couldn't hear like I could. And
is that why you went out on night patrol, to find out where?
Oh yes, find out what was happening. You see, you had to crawl. There was rolls of barbed wire. You had to crawl through the barbed wire first. That all got wound round you. There were supposed to be lanes through the barbed wire where you could get through. Oh, that was all right if you had got plenty of time. But if you were out, as I know, on one occasion we were in between the two trenches, and suddenly the Turks started opening fire ready for an attack, and Major Nathan called out to us to retire, and we had to come back quickly because we thought they were going to attack, and we had to get through our barbed wire, and we all got caught up in it and got in a hell of a state before we could get down into our own trenches, because crawling through rolls of barbed wire isn't the funniest thing out.
When you weren't on night patrol, where did you sleep and what bedding were you given?
Well, again, you didn't sleep. You didn't have any beds. There were no such thing as beds, darling. no such things as beds. You were just in these trenches. That was all. That was your life. That was your whole existence and your abode. And I say there was no dugouts or anything. There was no billets or anything of that on there at all. You simply were in those frontline trenches, and they only extended. You remember that the troops were only 2 miles inland. That's as far as we got when the Turks. They got right through at first when they first landed. But then, you see, they got no support and they were driven back. And the Turkish Turkish commander, was it Mustafa Kemal or something or other, he rounded up a lot of two or three battalions of troops and came down and attacked our fellas and deprived them of the very ground that they had won, where they could, on the hill, was it Achibaba or one of them, where they could actually see Constantinople. And they were driven back, and of course they never regained those positions again. There was terrible losses trying to recapture those hills again, but they never got them. And so consequently, these final lines, by the time we'd got there, they were only 2 miles inland, and all you got behind you was the sea. No habitations, no dugouts or refuges or anything at all. There was just this one tent on the big marquee on the beach where the medical chaps could go. Some of the fellas, gunners and that, their batteries were hidden in nullahs. They were like a deep ravine, and they were able to holler out holes in the side of those nullahs. That was the nearest approach to a dugout that you could see, not like those elaborate affairs they were on the Western Front. There was nothing like that. And the troops in the frontline trenches, you'd got no cover, no shelter at all. You'd simply got the trenches where you lived and slept, and all you had was a fire step. The trench would be up about 5 or 6 feet, according to how you could make it, and then about 2 feet off the ground there'd be a fire step where you stood on to fire over the top. And that was your only protection. And then at various places, if you were lucky, I'll say, to get hold of some corrugated iron and or some planks to put across the trench and shove some earth on it to stand under, that was the only protection from the weather. There was nothing else. And you could never take your clothes off or talk about going to bed. There was no bed. I didn't see the inside of a bed, not until I got back to Egypt. Never. No, there was no beds. Even when we came off and went to Imbros, there was no question of any beds. You just slept in your clothes.
Was dysentery a problem?
Dysentery was a terrible problem. I've seen chaps fade. I remember the big drummer of our band. I think he weighed about 12 stone. He had it, and the last time I saw him, he was on the beach waiting to be carried off. And he'd gone down to about 4 or 5 stone. He'd faded away. He died soon after, as a matter of fact. But dysentery was a terrible problem, because the water, any water that we got, was so bad, and there was no food or anything, proper food. You ate anything, didn't know where it had come from or what it was, as long as it looked edible. And consequently, everybody was running with diet with dysentery, and even right up to the time when we got off, and the chaps then were still suffering from it. I can tell you about that later when we talk about getting to Egypt and some of the experiences. But then another big trouble that I haven't mentioned yet, of course, and that was one of the biggest things of the lot, was the lice. We are absolutely infested with lice, mind you. You picked them up in the army soon after you went abroad. I don't remember having them in Malta, but when we got to Egypt and anywhere like that, I remember we started getting lice. And by the time we got to Gallipoli, we were absolutely infested with them. They were all in your clothes, all in the seams of your trousers and your shirts, and all horrible little things about an inch long, whitish looking things that used to bite and irritate you and drive you around the bend. And I know if we did have managed to get some matches or anything, one of the things we used to do was to roll down our trousers or our clothes and light a match and burn it all the way up the seams to burn these blasted lice. Our relatives knew about them, and they used to send us tins of anti-lice ointment. I think the swines used to feed on that, because once we'd rub that on ourselves, they seemed to be more active than not. It wasn't very popular, but they stayed with us. Well, right to the time we got to France, I think, that we were still lousy. It was a horrible feeling. The first time you discovered from a clean living life that you've got lice, it's an indescribable feeling. And I remember, I think it was in France, where they stuffed all our clothing in a boiler, like a traction engine, in the boiler of a traction engine, put it under steam pressure. They thought that would kill them, but it didn't. When they come out, the clothes were all wrinkled, but the lice were still alive. No, that was a terrible problem, for which there was really no answer. Apart from that, I say the chief thing was the shortage of water, shortage of any amenities, supplies, and the ability to clean yourself and wash and change clothes. I really can't recall when we did get a change of clothes. I think back and try to remember where, but even after the evacuation, when we were taken to Imbros. We were only there 3 or 4 days, but I'm pretty sure we didn't get any change of clothing. We might have got some clean socks, I don't know, but I really can't remember. I don't think we got there until we got back to Egypt.
Were you given any official medication for?
Any medication that we got came from a chap. I think he was the assistant. He wasn't a medical officer. He was only a sort of an assistant to a medical officer who had a small bay in one of the trenches where chaps used to go and see him if they were sick. And I think he used to chiefly dole out quinine. What was the other stuff he used to give us? Some other stuff that was supposed to calm you down. I can't think what it was now. But I know it was some stuff he used to give us so that he said that if you had much more of this, he says, by the time you get home, you'll all be impotent. But I can't think what it was now. And I think it was, I believe, as a matter of fact, I think it was lime juice or something to avoid scurvy. I believe that was it. I think it was lime juice. And we used to go there for a dose of this. And I think that was the stuff he said, when you get home, you'll all be impotent. But apart from, and of course, there was the ordinary stretcher bearers and medical people on the battalion who could bind up any wounds for you or anything. But nobody was ever sent down to the beach if they could still hold a gun and fire, because they were so short of men. There was nobody to man the trenches towards the end. It got less and less. But they would bandage you up and send you back, and you'd have to carry on with it. I mean, so many wounds or cuts or tears from the barbed wire got septic that nearly everybody wore bandages around their arms, their head and legs. And we were a terrible looking lot. I think there were enough to frighten the Turks without any fighting.
Were there enough dressings available?
Oh, you could get these dressings. You were issued when you went on with the field dressing. It was just a small pack that fitted inside a pocket on your tunic. Yeah. By the way, there's one thing I haven't told you about, and that was the you asked about the equipment, and that was the issue of gas masks. Now, gas was never used on the peninsula, as far as I know. I'm sure it wasn't, but we were issued with these gas masks before we landed. They consisted of a small pair of cotton ball, about 6 inches long by 3 inches wide, about half inch thick, and that was impregnated with some chemical, I don't know what it was, and then that was wrapped in a long length of gauze. It was folded over in a strip, and then the idea was, and that was all wrapped up into a package and given to her for use in the event of gas attack. And we were told that that this pad was impregnated with a chemical, but in the event of a gas attack, to make quite sure, you should urinate on the pad. See, that was handy. We didn't have enough water to urinate. To urinate on the pad and place it over your mouth and tie the gauze, pieces of gauze, around the back of the neck. Well, fortunately, we never had a gas attack, but we found a very good use for the gauze on these packs, because we got so fed up with flies that we used to rip this gauze off this pack and unwind it and drape it over our heads underneath our caps to protect our face from the flies, especially if you were trying to get 5 minutes rest in the trench, because the flies would immediately gather around your eyes and your mouth, you see, and it did protect them from that. But that was the only use that we ever made of it. But I think we were threatened with being put on a charge for destroying them, but we took that chance. But as for other, there was no other medical supplies that we had, as far as I recollect, at all. I say the medical provision was very poor indeed. There was one point about the not having watches, that on duty on the trench, when you're on guard, you were supposed to have 2 hours on and 4 hours off. I believe that was the regulation time. Well, it got so short of men eventually that we used to have to do 2 hours on and only got 2 hours off. Well, I've seen men falling asleep at their post standing in the trenches because they were so tired. And when that first happened, some of the men were put on a charge and court-martialed, or threatened with court-martial, for falling asleep on their post. But then it turned out that they couldn't charge them with that, because they hadn't had their legal 4 hours rest period, and that had to be washed out. But that was all the rest we got in towards the end, when the manpower got so short. 2 hours, 2 hours on, 2 hours off.
What was discipline like?
Well, discipline was all right. The men did what they told. They didn't mutiny. I think they were a bit too cowed and worn out, and I think they'd all given up hope. We'd all pretty well given up hope of ever coming off. I never thought that I'd get home again. I never thought we'd see England again. I thought that was a finish. The Turks would make a big attack and we'd all be wiped out. That, as far as we could see, was the only solution. That we seemed to be the forgotten army. Nobody seemed to bother about us or at all. That we were the attack had fizzled out, and there it was. We were left there to stagnate, and nobody seemed to care what happened. I say Kitchener came out and said, well, it must be evacuate them all. And but other than that, nobody bothered.
What about punishments?
Well, no, there was no punishment. Nobody ever got punished. I never remember anybody being punished. Because in the old days, if you were found asleep on duty like that, you'd be strapped to a gun wheel or something in the boiling hot sun. But that didn't happen out there. I don't remember anybody being punished for anything, really. But I say the officers did the best they could, but they couldn't do much. They were as hard put to it as what we were. They hadn't got it.